Good afternoon, Paul Alcoholic. I'll put a timer on too. Thank you very much. I'm super grateful to have the opportunity to speak here. It's kind of crazy to say old timer because really one of the things that I aspire to do is be teachable. And just remember that, you know, whoever got up first today is probably the one that's got the most time. My sobriety date is July 11th, 1985, and my home group is Saturday Morning Men at Peace. It's off the Xerxes. It used to be the old Sahara meeting. You know, I have been taught to share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And here's the reality. From a drunkalog perspective, I'm a garden variety alcoholic and drug addict. I mean, that's plain and simple. I loved it so much that it stopped working. And very early, I was intervened on by the state, by the family, by a lot of different people. So I had two choices. And I remember it very vividly. Go to jail or get sober. And it was a really tough decision to make. I remember saying, can I think about it? And everyone was like, are you kidding me? But the reality is, I chose the route of sobriety, and I became a master of the first step. I knew from the first day that I was a crazy alcoholic. Kids just didn't drink the way that I did, and they weren't drinking at school, and they weren't doing drugs in school, and they just didn't disappear for days on end. And so I had no problem admitting that I was an alcoholic and that my life had become unmanageable. I wasn't living at home anymore. You're right. I did most of my damage in St. Paul. I went to St. Thomas Academy, and at the end, my family, we had moved to Edina, and I was living in the woods in an abandoned camper, and that was, I thought I had arrived. That was just, give me a break. So, admitting that I was powerless over alcohol, like I said, I was really good at that, and thank God for St. Paul Uptown House, and for Perkins, because really, if it wasn't for the St. Paul Uptown House and Perkins, there's a high likelihood that I would not be sober. I spent probably 3 years going to Uptown House and then carting myself all the way back to Edina and sitting in Perkins till like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. It was before cell phones. My mother would call up to Perkins and say, can you tell Paul Kramer he needs to come home now? The irony in that is, you know, there was a group of us that were young when we sobered up, and really all they cared about is that we didn't drink. So I thought that that was all that mattered, is that if I didn't drink, everything was great, and I would prove to the world that I would be a success. Now, just saying that statement, it should be clearly evident that I had a huge chip on my shoulder, and I was literally going to prove to everyone that they were wrong, I was better than all of them, and I was going to amount to something. And that's the attitude that I took. I just didn't drink. I was really good at not drinking. I was still really fun. I mean, most people would probably thought that I was stoned out of my mind. And so I went to a lot of meetings. I had a lot of great fellowship. The buddies that I met within my first year of sobriety, they're still my best buddies now. And we talk every single day. But that was about as good as I did. I wasn't... You know, I'm fun, I'm funny, and I thought I was, you know, not an angry person. But as I went through, you know, early sobriety, and I started to, you know, acquire some success, you know, I really started to think that, you know, everything that was happening in the world was a direct result of me. And I just kept on perpetuating that behavior. Now, thankfully, dumb luck. I ended up getting married. I have 3 beautiful boys. I've done very well professionally. And as I accumulated more time, and by the way, I would tell you how much time I had. I mean, I was such an arrogant asshole. Oh, pardon me, sorry. Because I thought time was an indicator of success. And I was accumulating all these days turned into years. I'm doing very well professionally. I have this wonderful family. And, you know, believe it or not, I got more miserable as time went on. And I started to think, if this is what not drinking is all about, this is a load of crap. I mean, it is crazy. And one of the statements in the book that I love is, I'll find it here in a second. But what started to happen is I got a gigantic ego, and my program got smaller and smaller and smaller. My ego kept on getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and my program was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Mind you, I'm still going to meetings, but I'm not going to the same meeting all the time, because God forbid any of you get to know me. I don't have a sponsor anymore, and I'm working the steps off the wall. And I'm feeling miserable. It's no wonder I felt the way that I did. And the reality was, I thought I was the solution. I thought just not drinking was plenty good. And it wasn't until, I got to the point where it was, I have a very nice life insurance policy, very nice house. It became too much. Life became really, really long. And this is with not drinking. Now, granted, from the outside, most of you would have loved what I had. I mean, I had it all. But on the inside, I was ripped apart. And so what does a good alcoholic do when they feel like that? I created more resentments. I quit this job that I was working at where I did very, very well. I quit it on a resentment. And then I started, again, that I'll show you attitude. I decided to start a business. I don't know how to start a business. And not only start a business, a software company. I don't even know how to write software. And I decided to go into business, go into partnership with a guy I couldn't stand. Didn't even like to be in the same room with him. That was my best thinking. Quit on a resentment, a great job. Start a business when I had no idea about, and go into business with someone that I couldn't stand. Just could barely tolerate him. And my first day, February 4th, 2008, I remember it like it was yesterday. We're sitting in an office. Office behind Plums on Snelling there. And right off the alley, there was two desks, and we literally were right behind Plums. And I'm like, I have to go to a meeting. And I ended up at Cozy's men's group Monday in Edina. Now, of course, because I'm a freaking snob, I thought, it's in Edina, they're going to have white people, I'm going to be able to relate. So that's how I got there. My ego, because it was in Edina, was going to be, the class of people that I needed to be with, that I could relate with. And to this day, I remember it was on the ninth step, and of course, it's speak as the moment moves you, and I decided to interject and share my wisdom, and I'm still embarrassed by what I said, still to this day. And I still go every Monday. I've maybe missed it in the last 8 years, maybe eight times. But I met a guy there. Well, I ran into a guy that I knew, and I said, I need a sponsor. Because I just got to the point where I got to do something different. And he pointed out a guy to me, and I'm like, really? That's the best that you can do? And he's like, that guy's got to be your sponsor. And I got to a point of desperation. And to me, that's probably one of the greatest gifts I've ever been given, is the gift of desperation. Before, it was just like, I'm going to die. There was no gift of desperation. It was just really binary. I'm going to die, or I can choose to live. And granted, it was a tough decision for a moment, but I was still relatively young. When I went to Cozy's and asked that gentleman to be my sponsor, Robert B., I was desperate. Because nothing was working. I had everything that I thought that I would ever want. That's the irony. I got everything that I thought I would ever want. When this happens, I'll be happy. When that happens, I'll be happy. All of it. And I was more miserable than when I was drinking. It was the craziest thing in the world. So I asked this guy to be my sponsor, and he's like, okay, meet me Tuesday here. So I meet him Tuesday at a Caribou. And I thought I would, share my wisdom. And I tell him all about me, and I got 20 years, and blah, 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 blah. And he sat there, and he looked at me, and he goes, I want nothing that you have. And it just hit me in the head. And he said, Kramer, you are a seven-day-a-week alcoholic. If you think any differently, I'm not the guy for you. So right there and then, we sat down, and we read the big book. Now, prior to that, I skimmed through the big book. It'd been a doorstop. It'd been a, you know, a cup rester, whatever the hell you call those things. And I remember reading it, and I'm reading Bill's story, and I'm like, this is stupid. This happened in the Great Depression. I got nothing in common with this guy. And then I'm reading there's a solution, and it's all this God BS. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? And so I never really grasped the 12 steps originally. And probably because I thought the only thing that mattered was to stay sober. I didn't think that I had other problems. So he read the big book to me. The first 164 as the first 100 did it. And he read the black. Apparently there was nothing in between the lines. And when we got to Bill's story, I'm like, you know, I've already read this. And he's like, of course you have. And he goes, I just want you to close your eyes, and I want you to relate to the emotional landscape. You don't have to relate about to the time when it was, any of that type of stuff. I don't know when my timer stopped. And two, holy crap. I said 10 minutes is really hard. And as he's reading the big book and I'm listening to Bill, I fancied myself a leader. I proved to the world I'd be a success. I could relate to all that stuff. And then as we started to get into more about alcoholism, you know, it hit me like a bolt of lightning. When I first sobered up, I admitted that I was an alcoholic. My life was crazy and manageable. It didn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. I had never conceded to my innermost self. That surrender. It's one thing for me to admit, yeah, it's easy. I'm an alcoholic. I admit that I have red hair. That's super easy to do. But to concede and surrender, that was the huge win for me. And then it was very easy to start to understand or comprehend what the big book was talking about. So when in step two came to believe in a power greater than myself, you know, I thought I was God. I was playing God, and I was terrible at it. And, you know, the relief that came that there is something greater than myself, that I don't need to be the solution, was mind-boggling. Then to go to step three, which I struggled with. Again, I had a huge ego. I still have a huge ego. I got to battle that every single day. The first time I saw step three, I thought that was because I'm the oldest grandson of a big Irish family, and you're supposed to become a priest. And so I went through that early on, and when I was interviewing to be a priest, I'm getting through to the final stages, and they said, why do you want to be a priest? And I said, I wanted to be the first American pope. And that's when they said, you know what? This is not a meritocracy. It is, you know, that's something that is granted you. And of course, I didn't become a priest, but this time when I did the third step, the only thing that I did was made a decision to do four. That was it. I'd done four steps before, but they probably weren't very fearless or thorough. Then I did the fourth step where I did it out of the book, not the Hazleton one, not one you get in a group, literally out of the book. And it blew my mind that I had a warehouse of resentments. Quick story, real before, I was seeing a therapist because there a big tragedy happened in the family, and my wife convinced me to finally go. And this guy was specialized in anger management. I'm like, why the hell am I here? Fast forward 6 weeks later, I got fired because we would scream at each other in these therapy sessions. And I just didn't know that anger was actually, you know, resentment was just anger relived. I was just retelling some made-up fantasy that I had. So I got it all down on paper. You know, where I'd have been selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and afraid. It freaked me out. I mean, I literally had, in that fourth step, 112 resentments. Then I looked at my fears. I thought I was fearless. I would jump off a cliff. I would do anything. But internally, I had crazy, weird fears. And saying that to another man was huge. Sex inventory, that was really, you know, vanilla. And then to do the financial inventory, because I wanted everything that you guys had. And if you wouldn't get, I would go to great lengths to get it. Hook, you know, whatever. I would steal it, what have you. Then step six, you know, my approach originally to step six and seven is, you know, I'm going to put on a calendar. I'm going to get rid of this defect this week, that defect next week. And I didn't realize that step six is pray for the willingness to have it removed. And then step seven is it's none of your business. I'll remove it if I think it's necessary. And great relief. Step eight, you know, that was where the light bulb went off. It went from what you guys did to me to what can I do to make it right? You know, one of my best AA buddies says it's the most spiritual step in the 12 steps. Nine, just to sit across from those people that I had harmed, my enemies, those that I had resented, and to be able to communicate where I had been selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and afraid. Huge weight off my shoulder. Huge. 10, I'm the king, my sponsor will laugh. Of, you know, when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. Done? I'll wrap it up real quick. Here's the deal with 10. You said I could go a little over. Here, what I've learned about 10 is I don't do anything overtly wrong, but my thinking is so screwed up. I live in a fantasy world half the time. And that's when I have to promptly admit is that, look, this is the crazy thinking I'm having. Is it right? And he's going to tell me 99% of the time it's not. 11, meditation has changed my life unequivocally. It, you know, that 20 to 40 minutes that I get to sit quietly or as quiet as I can possibly be is amazing. And then I'll just end with 12. You know, the greatest gift, I love my children, I love my wife. I can't remember when they took their first steps, but I can remember when I've met a guy and he's gotten his first 30 days or his first 24 hours or his first year. It is the single, it's hands down the greatest joy in the world. And I love what they say at the end here, and this is how I'll end it, is the great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of my life today is the absolute certainty that my Creator has entered into my heart and life in a way which is indeed miraculous. It's unbelievable. If you would have told me, I'd be saying God is my higher power freely and not think that I was a Jesus freak, I would have thought you were insane. He has commenced to accomplish those things for me which I could never do today. And that is true. That is the greatest gift that I've been given. And I'll end with this. I am not grateful to be an alcoholic. I would not wish it upon my worst enemy. But I am so grateful for the solution that we've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous. With that, I'll pass.
I'm Irish. This is dangerous. Hello, I'm Cindy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Cindy.
And now that you know I'm Irish, you know why I'm so grateful to be here today. Because left to my own perplexions, I would be drunker than a skunk on any given day, and was until I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 12-step by a friend I used to drink with. So, you know, on a Sunday afternoon, she asked me the deadly 20 questions. And this pathological liar told her the truth, because I had no idea where the questions were going. So, you know, did you ever pass out? Yeah. Did you ever say you're going to drink, you're not going to drink tonight? Did? Yeah. You know, so, I mean, it was just so blah, blah, blah. And then she had done, and I'm holding on to a glass of wine at the time. You know, and I'm sitting in my little apartment, you know, and she says, well, I think that probably you would find it helpful to go to Uptown tomorrow night at 6:00. It will be a Monday meeting, room 3, go in the door, go up the stairs, go straight ahead. They know all about you and they'll be ready for you. My brother at this point is 5 years sober, so I know you all are very nice people and there's nothing to really be worried about, but really? That's what you think I should do? Yes, I do think you need to go to that meeting. And, you know me. And so I guess I'll go. And so I get to Uptown, and I walk into that room. And, I walk into the house. I'm at the steps. My stomach sort of overturns. And I'm a nurse. I have seen more than God knows, and nothing upsets my stomach. But my stomach sort of turned like I was going to get sick. And I thought, oh, what's happening? And I says, well, she said to go up the stairs. I just went up the stairs and into this room and sat down. And this meeting was just starting. And they said, well, is there anybody new to the meeting? And just sort of sat there, you know, what? I don't know. Are they talking to me? So they went around the room and it came to me. And so when it came to me, I went, I'm sitting in an elder. And that is what I did for months. Months. It didn't matter what day. It didn't matter what time. It didn't matter who was there and if they had seen me before. I was sitting in an elder. Because at my best thinking, my best planning, landed me right where I didn't want to go. So what that did for me very early on is it told me I didn't really know what to do with my life. You know, and so that opened me up to be pretty teachable. Now I put in that little there, that pretty, because we don't stay that willing, at least this alcoholic didn't. I mean, when they said, and you're not God, I went, really? Have you ever seen me make a person so comfortable when they're in pain? I'm really quite godly. Yeah, well, as far as your life, as far as your decisions, you're nothing. Okay. And so I would go along, and so they said, are you praying to God? About what? And I told him about the Sears wish list. That was my prayer to God. It was sort of like that. And, you know, so then I was told to get up in the morning and read that third step prayer. I had to be told where to go in the big book. So I did. And then it got to be step three. And when they said, and you'll be turning your will and your life over to the care of God. Well, I had to come to the understanding that there was a God and he cared for me and I wasn't in charge of turning the world. Yeah. So that was a really big piece. And my friend who 12-stepped me, she said, Cindy, what time did you get up this morning? Well, you know, it depends on what shift I was working. So I'd say 6 o'clock. Was the sun up? Yeah. Did you get it up? No. So, I was really sort of kindergarten 101, you know. So I got through those first 3 steps, and I was very, very on fire to do the 4th step because I had this monkey on my back. There was something I did when I drank that was really haunting me. Of course, there were an awful lot of other things that should have been haunting me, but it was this one. That's one thing. And so they all kept saying, you have to have trust in God to do the 4th step. So it was like, and what does that mean? I mean, I really was there, and what does that look like? And so finally, one guy in my meeting who was just really a good guy to me, he said, I think you're almost there. And I went, where? Am I ready to do the 4th step? And he goes, no, I think you've almost got the 3rd step. So as life would go, I got through that whole first year. I got through my 4th steps, many 4th steps. I had to shed that onion. I got to make my first amend, and of course that was that monkey on my back. And I came to my Wednesday night meeting where there was an old ex-nun that I didn't know. She was an ex-nun because she wasn't in her habit. Sat down, and I was very inappropriate. My speech will just go that way. And she said, listen, young lady, that'll be the end of it. I says, but it's such a miracle that I got the package in the mail, I wrote my amendment letter, and I'm free of the monkey on my back. She goes, well, don't look to the left. There's quite a zoo on the other side. That's that nun stuff. They have plagued me my whole life. It's almost sort of like I had a little headband up here. Trouble. So I'm happy to say that now, you know, when I get through this, and I get my one-year pin, and everybody's clapping, and I'm crying. And they said, somebody in the audience said, "How did you do it?" And I said, "I have no idea." I said, "I think this is a miracle. Because I think God did it. God did do for me what I could not do for myself." And they said, she said, "I think you're going to make it." And so I was so happy. So most of my life in recovery is going that whole way all the time. I'm always surprised by God. You know, I really am still sort of that person that does have a little wish list. But I don't put a lot of steed in it anymore, because I do know that things that come to me that are my good idea, often they're not as satisfying as when God has the phone ring at 6 o'clock in the morning, and that's somebody in Florida who's in a real bad place. And I get to be of service to this person. I get to listen, and I get to say, you know, "Can you get yourself to a meeting? Do you have some numbers to call? I think the best thing you could do is get to the meeting. If not, call me back and we'll read out the paper." You know, and I know that those words, and even the words I just said to you now, are coming from God. They're not coming from me. Because my intention is to be of service to God in my life and to do the best I can and to leave my ego. I loved what he had to say about the whole ego thing, because you wouldn't think that someone so small could probably engulf this entire world. But there was a time that I believed if I could see over your head, I was taller than you. And so I have a little bit of acceptance problem, but I work on it every day. And to be real honest with you, part of that acceptance is part of my humility, and part of that humility is my blessing that I get to have things I couldn't even dream of. I have grandchildren that think I'm fun. I have a husband that at times thinks I'm brilliant. I have sponsees that call me and want to know what I think. And then, of course, I quickly have to go to the big book. Because we don't need any petting of that ego. And so all these years being at Uptown and being there and having them love me before I could love myself, and now I get to give back and love people before they can love themselves. And I can see the miracle, and I know it is unfolding in my life as long as I stay teachable, humble, and grateful. And with that, I'll pass.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Doug, and I'm an alcoholic. And when J.D. called me and asked me if I would be here to, I thought he was just inviting me out for ice cream. I didn't know that. But he told me that he wanted me to speak here. So and it truly is a pleasure to be here. My story, drunkalog, if you will, is probably the same as a lot of people. You know, I drank when I shouldn't have. I was unreliable when I needed to be most reliable. And I hurt people that were very close to me, and that's the bottom line. I grew up in Wisconsin, in southern Wisconsin, and I really didn't think that my drinking was abnormal, at that time, I guess. And then in 1971, I graduated from high school and I enlisted in the Army. And my plan was, I was going to do 3 years in the Army, get out of the Army, and go to school on the GI Bill. And 22 years later, I'm standing at my own retirement party, and I'm going, what, what happened here? I was going to do this gig for a couple of years. But anyways, I spent a career in the Army, and it was when I went in the Army that my drinking really took on. I mean, it like it had jets on it. It took on. I fell in with some guys who was my first assignment after training was stateside, and I fell in with a lot of guys. It was a combat unit, and fell in with a lot of guys who were having their first tour back stateside after leaving Vietnam. And I just was in awe of these guys, was in complete awe of them. And I wish that I would have had the same experiences that they did at the time. But one of the things, and I wanted to be just like them, and one of the things that I could do like them, those guys drank with a purpose. I mean, they really drank with a purpose. And that's one of the things that I could do. So I set out about doing that, my drinking just took off like it had jets. And it was pretty cool at first. I was in with a bunch of older guys, that were my superiors in rank and everything, and I hung out with them, and I thought that was pretty cool. And then it started to become a problem. People started to grumble a little bit, and not like the fact that we would take off at noontime, at lunchtime, and go to my platoon sergeant's house, and maybe we'd come back to work. Maybe we wouldn't. It just depends. And so that started to become a problem. When I got sober, I had 13 years in the Army, and I had screwed up a marriage. And I always thought during those years, life just absolutely sucks. It's being really unkind to me. I'm a good guy, I think. I'm fairly smart. I don't think I'm hurt anybody's eyes to look at it. Why is all this stuff happening to me? And I couldn't understand all that. And I was had screwed up a marriage. My wife, after 7 years, my first wife after 7 years, had told me, "Look, this is the way you want to live. That's up to you. But me and your daughter, we're not being a part of this. We didn't sign on for this." So they left. Most people would think, "Oh my God, I'm devastated." My thought was, "Good, now nobody can complain about how much I drink now, and I can get as drunk as I want to." But I was a drill sergeant down in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and two guys who were drill sergeants with me took me to my first AA meeting under the guise of taking me out for a cup of coffee on a Saturday night. So it was a Saturday night speakers meeting in Lawton, Oklahoma. And I didn't know that that's where we were going. I just thought we were going out for a cup of coffee, which I thought was a little strange, but someone told me I should go with these guys, so I did. And wound up at an AA meeting. And it was in a setting much like this, and at the end of the meeting, it was a speaker's meeting, and one of the guys that took me, one of the guys who was a drill sergeant with, he was a squad leader for the meeting that night, and he gets up after the speaker was done, and he starts with the chips. And he says, he picks up this white poker chip and he says, "This is the surrender chip." And he goes on to explain that. And he says, "Is there anybody here that has a desire to stop drinking?" And he looks right at me like this. And everybody in the whole world turns and looks at me like this. I'm like, "Well, what the heck? Might as well give this one a go." So I got up there and everybody got to their feet and was applauding. And I thought, what's this? What are they clapping for? I didn't do anything, And so, anyways, that began my journey into sobriety, and I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since that night, and that was the 8th of April, 1985. Thank you. I can assure you that I had very little to do with that. I had almost nothing to do with that. It's a fellowship and a lot of other things. But I had a lot of questions, a lot of concerns, a lot of things that just absolutely totally baffled me. I know one of the guys that took me to my first meeting, I asked him, one of the smartest things I did was with about 3 weeks sober, I asked him to be my sponsor, and he foolishly agreed. And that turned out really to be one of the smartest things I ever did. And somebody, the previous speaker was Cindy was talking about the third step, getting the third step. And that was the one, too, that when we got to that one, I said, Gary, and that was my sponsor, and I said, "Gary, I don't know that I can do this. You're asking me to just give everything over to this entity that I don't understand. I'm not even sure. I'm sure there's a God, but I pictured him with a some big guy with a clipboard that every time I did something wrong, he put a check mark in one column, and every time I did something right, he put a check mark in the other column, and at the end of my life, if the check marks didn't equal up, well, I'm in trouble. It's going to be warm where I'm going, to say the least. And that's what I envisioned God to be. And he said, so you want to be master of your own fate, captain of your own destiny, that kind of thing? I said, yeah, exactly. And he said, well, you've done such a great job with it so far, haven't you? And I couldn't argue with that. I could not find an argument with that. He was absolutely right. Somehow or another, the days turned into weeks, the weeks turned into months, and months turned into years of sobriety. One of the things that I have a little bit better understanding of how I stay sober now, I have a sponsor. I am a sponsor. I have a home group that I call my home group. It's Friday night, 6:30, Egan Burnsville Savage group. And I go to that meeting regularly. Very, very seldom do I miss that meeting. I do read the big book, and I had to kind of laugh when the previous speaker got up and said just read the, I only read pages of print on it. That's my first sponsor gave me my first big book too, and he said, here, I want you to read this. And I said, well, which part do you want me to read? He said, just the pages with words on it. And I said, okay, well, where do you want me to start? He said, how about page one? That would work. And I said, okay, all right, fine. And so so we kind of went through that process together. And one of the things that we say is when we read the opening in chapter 5 of the big book, we say, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. What I tell newcomers a lot is because when I first came in, I wasn't really sure that I wanted what you had. In a lot of cases, I wanted what everybody else had. I didn't want anything about what I had. I wanted what everybody else had. And so what I tell newcomers now is that you may not want what I have, and if you don't, that's okay. But you should stick around long enough to want what you have. And when you want what you have, that's the miracle. Thank you. When you want what you have, that's where the miracle happens. And miracles do happen in these rooms. They do. And if you haven't experienced that miracle yet, it's just because you haven't been here long enough. You haven't been through enough meetings. See, if I walk out of a meeting and I decide, that's it, I'm never going back to that place again, never going to an AA meeting again, well, I don't know. The next meeting I would have gone to might have been when I heard exactly what I needed to hear to kind of bring everything into focus or meet the person that I was supposed to meet to help me, help me walk through the steps and everything else. And in deference to our first speaker, I teach at St. Thomas Academy. So, and I know what that's like. I've been teaching for 22 years now, teaching high school boys for 22 years now. And boy, that's I can talk long about that, but I won't. That helps me. The principles that I learn in practicing this program helps me through on a daily basis. One of the things. One of the promises says we'll intuitively know how to handle situations used to baffle us. Well, that was easy for me. Everything baffled me, especially relationships. And now relationships don't baffle me so much because I know that people are going to be people, that they're not going to bend to my whims and my desires. They're going to be themselves, and they should be themselves. And I have to accept that. And sometimes that's not too easy to do when you're dealing with teenagers. But it is necessary. Thank you for letting me be here tonight.
Hello, everyone. I'm Julie. I'm an alcoholic. Good to be here today. I want to thank JD, the best dancer in AA, for asking me to speak today. And also want to thank all the people that serve at Intergroup for all their service. I just am grateful for them keeping AA going and all the volunteers that keep AA alive and the fun events that they put on too. So, I'm nervous, sorry. Okay, so my sobriety date is January 24th, 1988. So I guess that's 29 years.
And currently I have two home groups, because I just like them so much that I have two home groups. Monday night, Came to Believe, and you are all welcome to join us there. It's 7 o'clock on Mondays at the Highland Rec Center. And we read out of the book, Spiritual Awakenings. And then Saturday mornings, I go to a women's meeting at 10 o'clock. It's called Basic Text, and we read out of the big book. And that meets at St. John's the Evangelist Church. So let's see. I should look at the time here. Oh, where's the timekeeper? How am I going to know? Okay. So real quickly, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I grew up in an alcoholic family. My mom was the alcoholic, and my dad was the angry person that wanted to keep everybody in line. And anyway, because of growing up in that family situation, I didn't like alcoholism. I vowed to myself I wasn't going to be an alcoholic, and just, yeah, really felt strongly about that. And like a lot of other alcoholics, I felt very uncomfortable in the world, and was pretty shy, not with my close friends, but in general. And so I stayed sober all the way until I was 17 years old. And anyway, I basically what happened is, one by one, all my friends that didn't drink started to drink, and then I just got really curious about what the big deal was. And when I drank, I was like, wow, now I know what the big deal is. I don't feel super self-conscious, and I can talk to people, and I can talk to boys. And so right away in my life, in the beginning, alcohol did great things for me. And, you know, like it says in the big book, and I don't know if this is true for all women, but it was true for me that I became an alcoholic pretty quickly. I drank for 5 years and thought it was normal. And when I went away to college in St. Paul here, I had seen the movie Animal House, and I was just so excited about college. I thought, that's what it's supposed to be. but you know, right away I had the blackouts, I had the really bad hangovers, but I kept comparing myself to the people who drank like I did. For the most part, I would hang out with those people. But slowly, I don't know, I became very depressed, actually. Even though having fun was what I thought what drinking was all about, I had a hard time getting up in the morning, was scared to go to class in college, and I don't know, I thought I was going crazy, and so I went to a therapist, and she started asking me about my drinking, and I said, well, I don't drink every day, and I thought an alcoholic was like what my mom was, and she drank alone. I'm always with people, so I can't be an alcoholic. But she asked me to try to quit for a week, and I didn't make it. I had a good excuse to not make the whole week, I thought, but I didn't make the whole week. So I went into treatment. I had an evaluation, and I went into outpatient treatment. And when I was there, they suggested I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I tried out 3 meetings. And one of the meetings I went to, I really had a closed mind. I was comparing myself to others. I wanted everybody to be just like me so I could relate to them. And I wasn't really listening to, you know, how my disease was like theirs. And I remember people coming up to me and like, do you have a sponsor? Do you have a sponsor? Do you have a sponsor? And I was just like, ah! And I remember telling them I was going to go to a Grateful Dead concert, and they thought, they kind of told me that wasn't a good idea, and so I decided not to go back to AA. But somehow I stayed sober for 2 years, but I was very crispy and dry by the end of those 2 years. I met somebody in AA who I could relate to. They were having a lot of fun. Apparently that seems to be the thing I strive for. But And they had friends that were sober. And I don't know, this person, that I wanted what they had. And so I thought, I'll try those meetings out again. And so I went to Uptown, and they read How It Works. And I really listened to it. And when they talked about A, we're alcoholic and cannot manage our own lives, that was true. And B, no human power could relieve us of our alcoholism, that was true. My boyfriend, I put all my problems on him, whined at him constantly, and he still couldn't make my life better. And then C, that God could and would if he ever saw it. And I thought, yeah, well, maybe these people here know what they're talking about. And so, in a lot of ways, AA became my higher power. It was a power greater than myself. People were all staying sober together. So I continued to go, but I was such a slow learner in AA. I thought, I didn't realize that people went to more than one meeting a week. I think I waited 2 years to get a sponsor because I was like, oh, I'm waiting for, it's like I thought I was going to get married or something. I'm waiting for the perfect person. And finally, my home group was like, this person's going to be your sponsor. And so that's how I got my first sponsor, and it worked out great. She walked me through the steps, and I was no longer trying to run the show. You know, I mean, I didn't give up right away, and it's still a struggle to not try to run the show. You know, it's like I've always believed in a higher power, but I just didn't think that higher power was going to take care of my problems or, you know, how I thought things should go. I don't know. But, you know, God is either everything or God is nothing, and that's something I have to remind myself of every day. How are we doing on time? My sponsor suggested I go to more than one meeting a week, and I started to do that, and I started going to Big Book meetings, and somebody introduced me to the Joe and Charlie tapes, which just blew my mind. I really finally understood the Big Book, and it just really helped my sobriety. And then I got involved in service, and OMD was my home group for many years. And that group, saved my life. It introduced me to so many wonderful friends and got me involved in service. So today I still have a sponsor, and I still sponsor other women, and that is the joy in Alcoholics Anonymous for me. I guess with that I will pass. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Peter, and I'm an alcoholic. And I found it necessary to have a drink since August 28th, 1989, and for that I'm grateful. My home group is Third Edition Big Book Study Group. We meet on Monday nights, 7:30, on the corner of Thomas and Snelling. If anybody's looking for a meeting or group to attend on Monday night, we'd love to have you. Please come out and see us. Oh boy, man. Janie asked me. Hey, you know what? Now, he doesn't know. Mike is a timer. He took over the timer, right? But the deal is with Mike, he just asked me to sponsor him not too long ago. So he's going to be paying double for his trouble. Right? Anyway, it's an honor and a pleasure, but most of all, it's a privilege to be here among all you good people here for myself. And the people who spoke before me, you did a fantastic job. Thanks for sharing. I know a couple of you, and I look around the room, I got some of you know me. I when I'm up here and I do this, and I give, I got my sweat rag. Because the deal is, you know, some people, you know, you turn red when you're nervous, and me, I have a tendency, it would be kind of hard to see me turn red. And so I sweat profusely, but I'll be okay. especially only for 9 minutes now. Anyway, the truth of the matter is, JD asked me to come and do this, and we were talking about doing it. He said, you know, we're back over at Redeemer Arms now. I said, oh, okay, that's fine. I know it's that. He said, yeah, you know, it's in our hood. And I said, our hood, you know. it's funny that, you know, we're here because this is where I did a lot of my stuff. In this area, not too far away. Some of you might know what I'm talking about. But nevertheless, I don't want to get into that because most of us in here, like people have already said, we did the same thing. A lot of similarities with that stuff. I'd like to really, you know, use this time and utilize this time for, you know, the recovery part for me, because this year has been a real turnaround, a new game changer for me this year has. I had a year similar to this in 2009, and what happened is in 2009, I lost a girlfriend and two brothers in the same year. And when I introduced myself, it's but for the grace of God that I didn't drink through that. That was a rough time. One was expected, we were braced for that. The other one was unexpected. I'm the youngest of seven, and all of us have been affected with this deal called alcoholism. And the thing is, the one brother, that's what he died from, an accidental overdose. And so it's a treacherous disease, what I found out. But, you know, the recovery piece for me through studying the big book, and that's what we do. We don't just read the big book on Monday nights. We study the book. We have a dictionary person there who, if a person, if we're reading, a word comes up that we don't understand, we have a dictionary person there who shouts, who looks up the word for us. And then we open up the meeting with the third step prayer on our knees, and we close it with the serenity prayer on our knees. And yeah, it's a breakoff group from OMD. What happened is one of the members of OMD about 25 years ago got a resentment in a coffee pot and he found a church basement, and that's what happened with us. And the funny thing about it, that person who started that meeting, he was originally from New York, and he's went back to New York. And I just talked to him last week, so he's doing fine. For some of you people who didn't know who I'm talking about, I won't say no names, but he's doing fine. And thank God for that. But anyway, so with this book and this program has taught me, this program or this plan has taught me, and I think it says not so. I'm paraphrasing when I say this. It taught me to build a relationship with the God of my understanding. And the funny thing about it is if I slow down enough, I see the God of my understanding's fingerprint in all areas of my life. Again, I go back to this, JD asking me to come here to do this. And two blocks from here, it was ugly in the mid-80s for me. Two blocks away, so I could come here now, and I see that it's cleaned up. I met a friend of mine when I first moved here. I'm originally from Indiana. I talk funny, so please, if you don't understand me, just speak me after the deal, and I'll tell you what I meant, okay? I'll translate for you. But anyway, when I first moved here in 1977, I met a friend. We all had nicknames, and his name was Pookie. And Pookie, the deal is with Pookie, he doesn't belong to this fellowship or this program, but he's a real spiritual young man. And what happened was when I sobered up, I thought I knew a lot, but I didn't know much. But Pookie, it was a reason why he was put in my life then. And over from 1977 to 89, we kind of grew like this, but we grew back together. And so what happened was, I got sober, and I was going to a lot of meetings. I didn't go back to rehab. I was going to a lot of meetings, and I seen this sign on the wall. Some of y'all might have seen it, too. It says, but for the grace of God, there go I. And I was 30 years old when I sobered up, and I didn't know what that word grace meant. But where I come from, two blocks from here, you can't go around asking people what words like that mean, because they would laugh at you. And so But Pookie, was, for some reason, I had enough courage in me to ask Pookie, man, what's this word grace mean? And Pookie told me the word meant gift, unrewarded gift, a gift that we don't deserve. I said, oh, okay, and that made sense to me. And so, months go by and years go by. I got a friend. I think one of the speakers today said, you know, he's got friends from people that he met when he first came into the program. And so true for me. A lot of you people I met when I first started AA, or when I first came into the program. And you're still friends to this day. But anyway, I met this guy, Charlie, when I first moved. Well, I think I was 2 years sober when I met Charlie. And Charlie and I became really good friends. And just last year, I went through a rough time. Remember I told you that it was a couple of different times. And last year, I went through a rough time. And I would like to go into detail about it, but I don't think it's right for me to do it because it involved another person. And if it was just me, it would be one thing, but it involved another person. So I don't think it's appropriate for me to do that. Nevertheless, it was a rough time. My sponsor that I had for 20 plus years retired, decided to move back to Chicago, and I thought I could do a long distance sponsorship thing, but it wasn't enough. And that guy who I was saying about, Charlie, who was my best friend, became my sponsor. And the last 9 months of working with Charlie, my life has turned around because I'm doing things of what this program is said to do. And then, you know, Charlie did something to me that hadn't ever been done to me, and that was, instead of working the program out of the big book, he said, well, let's try the 12 and 12, and that's what we did. And then for some people, I know it might be strange for you to believe that the fourth step can be done out of the 12 and 12, but it has. And I'm gonna tell you, this time when I did that fourth step with Charlie, that fourth column ate my lunch, but it made a big difference. That's when the pendulum really started to swing again, because I was like that old grandfather clock in the corner. The pendulum had stopped. It just stopped. But then when I started working with Charlie again, and particularly with this fourth step that I just recently completed, it started swinging again. And today I heard somebody talk something about being happy. You know, I ain't looking for happiness. I'm looking for just to be content. And that's what I found. Just being content. And by the byproduct of doing the 12 step, going to jails, particularly Stillwater and AGC, I found this thing called happiness through my service. I'd like to thank y'all for being here and allowing me to be a service. I pass.
Hi everybody, my name is Ann Abrahamson and I'm an alcoholic. And it is by the grace of God, love and service of the fellowship and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My last drink was November 7th, 1987. And for that, that certainly wasn't my plan that day, for sure. Thanks to all the speakers and thanks, JB, for asking me to speak. Everybody knows how to get drunk. Right, you know, and so I'd like to focus a little bit more about my adventures of trying to stay in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I really thought, and I related a lot to everybody that spoke, but kind of the theme that I heard with a lot of them is, you know, there's ups and downs and ins and outs, and you know, we don't just land in here, everything goes great, and, you know, we just go about our business. At least that's not been my experience. I got sober in Iowa. I grew up there. That did not make me an alcoholic. Where's Doug? Doug usually gets me ahead of time. But, and, you know, in our book, it talks about the essentials for recovery are honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And I really didn't have any of that. And so I do know that it is by the grace of God that I'm here and sober and alive today. I got 12-step by a drinking buddy of mine. And he had gotten sober by 3 years before me. And I, like the last 6 months of my drinking, I found myself, I had become one of those people that I hated, those women that would cry and carry on, and that was me. And So I would show up at his place, and he finally asked me if I thought I had a drinking problem. And, you know, I had never considered that, because that's just what I did. I started drinking when I was about 12, and that's just what I did. I never tried to stop or anything. Didn't ever see a reason to. You know, like, why would you? That's just what I did. And so what I had never heard of AA. And he said, well, why don't you come, you know, meet me up at this meeting, we'll go. And this was a small town in Iowa, population about 4,000. And I didn't know that there was AA meetings other places. I don't know. I wasn't like a big thinker, you know what I mean, because I was too up in here. But so I go to this meeting, and I know I would have never gone had it not been for him meeting me there. I would have drank myself to death, not knowing what my problem was. But I go up there, and I walked in, and it was about a quarter of the size room, and it was in a room full of people about Doug's age, if you know Doug. It was all older gentlemen. And I was 22 years old when I walked in, and I thought, there's nothing that these guys have in common with me, you know. And I didn't know anything about what you did, why I was really there. I couldn't keep doing what I was doing. And the first guy that came up and shook my hand asked me if I was really looking for Alateen. And I didn't know what that was, but it pissed me off. So that was my first AA resentment. Certainly will not be my last. Because I'm sensitive. What I thought you did in AA was that you went and you quit drinking. You know, I really believed that I quit on my own. I make a decision. You know, I'm good at making decisions and sticking to them. And the problem that I had was that I didn't know that it was just, I didn't have a drinking problem. I really had a thinking problem. And I believed that I kept myself sober. I believed that I kept all of you sober and everybody else. You know, that was my job now. It was, you were not going to drink on my watch. And people didn't really appreciate that, like I thought they should. like, look what I'm all doing for you. But, you know, the only women that I really had any interaction with, and it was no interaction, it was through the grapevine. They had a big basket full of grapevines, and I would just sit and read those. And we were talking about this when we first got here, about hugging. If you'd have come at me, trying to hug me, I would have been, get away. You know, that, so, and I would just sit there and they'd let me read. And that's what I, you know, okay, so that's what I do. But I wasn't fixing the thinking problem at all. There's the thing that really strikes me after all these years, and I'm a slow learner, it's not overly profound, but, you know, that I have to continue to treat my alcoholism every day. And it is totally not about me. I can't fix my thinking with broken thinking. And I didn't know there was, like, no women to sponsor me or anything like that, and I wouldn't have listened to anybody anyway. You know, I believed that I was keeping myself sober. Fast forward, we ended up moving up to the cities here, and I was terrified of going to meetings or anything like that, but I thought, you know, I should probably go because you guys needed me. And I finally worked my nerve up to call Intergroup, and this was Minneapolis Intergroup, by the way. I called, and nobody answered the phone. And so, you know, I just shut the book on Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they didn't want me, clearly. They didn't answer the phone, so I was never going to darken the doorstep again. You know, I mean, that's typical alcoholic resentment. And so, you know, and it really was, that was, I had now made this decision, I'm on my own, and so now I have to do this all. And I can just give you a brief glimpse of my thinking at like 6-7 years sober. I'm seeing men in the grocery store and making them my husband for a month, you know, like that, fantasizing, you know, about this. Because I could not figure out how to live my life, and that's my problem. I don't know how to live life, you know, on my own. I don't know, I have no idea. And, you know, there was a whole lot of misery in between that period of time and when I finally ended up back in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, I had made up my mind not to come back. And so if you know me, you know it was pretty bad for me to have to like go back on that. But I showed back up to AA in the early 90s, and I walked in the door and there was a bunch of old men, you know, and God bless the men in Alcoholics Anonymous, because if they had just looked at my gender and said, you know, we can only help other men, I'd be dead, because they helped me and they showed me. You know, it was a collective. It took a lot of people to help me because I was barely teachable. I would read the book, that, you know, people would tell me to read this, and I'd read it, and I couldn't relate to it at all. But I knew that I needed help, and I had finally surrendered to coming to AA, but I had not surrendered. But somebody had said that I had not fully conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. Because alcoholic means I'm powerless. And unless I can admit that, I don't need another power. I'm still my own power. And I wanted to be my own power for a long, long time. And I remember sitting there reading the big book, thinking this has got, I gotta be able to find a solution here because I wanted some relief. And it's that paragraph in the big book where it says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our trouble. And I'm thinking, I'm screwed because that's not my problem. You know, I am not a self-centered person. I'm super giving. You know, look what I've always done. I've helped people. And it really, that was honestly the turning point for me. Had I not had the experience I had with that, as I'm sitting there, I absolutely was I was desperate for a solution, and I really believed I was in the wrong place now, because I had thrown it all into AA, and I was finding out that this was not, I was in the wrong place, and I was just hopeless in that moment. And what happened was that God spoke to me, and he said, "Who do you think you are to hold yourself above me?" And you know, I had not had that experience before, and it kind of got my attention. And, you know, I can't say that, oh, you know, everything was great now, but what that did for me was that was my came to believe moment. That was, I believed that I was in the right place. And now it's just been doing those things that I need to do to stay here. And this is my third event today that I've been to. That, and they weren't all AA events, but there was a funeral that I went to this morning for a guy that I know in the fellowship, and you know what, AA turns up. You know, we show up for each other. And then I went to District 13, put on a workshop, and there was 66 people there at a workshop, can you believe that, on sponsorship. And then I show up here, look at the turnout here, and I can tell you, the cool thing about not being sober a long time, because you know what, if you sit in your house all day and don't ever go out and don't die, you will stay sober, you know. But I have to be in recovery, and that's what I know is the big difference today, is that I have to be in recovery. And how I do that is being of service, being involved, staying involved. And I do that so that I get to stay here and I get to stay alive. I can tell you, I know just about at least one person at almost every table here. And that's not because I'm hugely, you know, the social person, because on my own, I'm not. But AA has taught me how to show up and meet people and get involved and stay involved. And that's how I get to stay here. I have a sponsor. She has a sponsor. I sponsor a lot of women in the program. And it is I can't require people to do much of anything. I can't get my kids to do much of anything. But one of the things I tell them right up front is that you will sponsor people in this program so that you can stay here. And for me, that's been the key of longevity, really, without killing myself. Without AA, I would have drank myself to death. And without the program, the book, going through the instruction manual, I'd have just blown my head off, you know. Yeah, and there are people that die of alcoholism in these rooms all the time, and that's super sad. So on that jury, no. One other thing that people showed up for was my husband's also in the program. Long story, I upgraded after a few years from my first husband. And he got sober when he was 19 years old. And right now he's got 40 years of sobriety.
Wow.
And, you know, it's interesting being married to yeah, with 40 years of sobriety. We don't sponsor each other. He has his deal. I have my deal. And we do AA very differently. But it's still the same program. We still have the same solution. And so that really has been interesting for me. Because I think I know how things should be done. You know what I'm saying? So we have a lot of good discussions about that. But a lot of people showed up for us when in February, he ended up in the hospital with congestive heart failure. And he was there for about a week. And then about 2 weeks later, he ended up in the hospital for another week for open heart surgery. And AA showed up for us, you know. And I just sold my life to this program, to God, and to all of you. Thank you so much.